This CityWire podcast is sponsored by Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust. Scottish Mortgage invests in some of the world's most promising and exceptional companies, from healthcare breakthroughs to electric vehicles to a green energy revolution. Scottish Mortgage takes stakes in businesses shaping our future economy and society. As with any investment, capital is at risk.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Advice Show. From advising clients to practice management, this podcast will give you UK and global insights into the financial planning profession. I'm Chloe, a report-led new model advisor, and today we are talking about fund size. I am joined by Adam Rackley, fund manager at Cape Wrath Capital. And Adam launched Cape Wrath Capital to combat what he perceives to be some of the biggest problem in the industry, the first being fund size and its impact on performance, and the other one being fee structures and how sometimes they don't really align with the interests of the investor. So today with Adam, we're going to talk about why fund size matters and what it means tangibly for advisors. So Adam, to start off, kind of a three-pronged question. Can you tell me about yourself, your fund, and your overall investment philosophy?
Sure. Thanks for having me on, Claire. I'm excited to be here. So a bit about myself to start with. So I've launched Cape Wrath Capital in 2016, and we're a single strategy manager. I've always worked, well, apart from a brief stint in the army, I've always worked in and around equity research and fund management. So I've been in the markets for the last 20 years or so. I'd say the first 7 years of my career were fairly conventional. So I'd started on a graduate program, and then I moved on to another firm. Spent 5 years at a firm called Montanara Asset Management, firstly as an analyst and then as a portfolio manager, looking after UK and European small cap equity strategies. And then I left the city in 2010. I wanted to spend a bit of time exploring my own investment philosophy. And I had a kind of a bucket list of things that I wanted to do. So I got married, lectured in finance, became a dad. My wife and I moved to India for 18 months, where we lived and worked in Mumbai. Had a couple of adventures, did all sorts of kind of fun stuff, and then came back to London in 2015, and then launched Cape Wrath in 2016. Cape Wrath is a UK equity boutique, delivering a low cost, high conviction stock picking with what we call a differentiated value strategy. And by differentiated value strategy, really what we mean is we focus on two things. First of all, we're looking for capitulation events as ideal entry points. So by a capitulation event, we mean a situation where existing investors are selling out of a position for emotional rather than rational reasons. So it could be that the stock has historically been kind of quality growth type stock. Maybe it's had a series of profit warnings over a number of years. The share price has shrunk such that the share is now a kind of de minimis position in that portfolio manager's portfolio, but it's, you know, causing them a lot of kind of anguish because of the losses they've incurred. Their investors are asking them lots of questions about the holding, and there comes a point where, for emotional reasons, it becomes, you know, easier to exit the position. We find that those can be ideal entry points, but we need to do a lot of work, obviously, in advance to understand whether this is a kind of value trap or a genuine value opportunity, and kind of value traps being the biggest risk facing value investors. The second thing we look for is an opportunity for a narrative shift. The way we see it, there are lots of different narratives in the market that determine, that are ways that different groups or individuals kind of interpret the story around a stock. So you've got existing shareholders, you've got short sellers, you've got the management, you've got the press, you've got sell side analysts, and all of these different groups have got kind of different different narratives. And what we look for, and at any one point in time, there'll be one of these narratives which is dominant and which is kind of driving the valuation of the stock. And we're looking for opportunities where we think there are a few catalysts that might cause that narrative to shift and therefore drive a re-rating to what we perceive is the kind of fair value for for that stock. So that's a bit about what we do at Cape Wrath.
And I seem to understand as well that one of the characteristics is that it's a fairly small fund in this capacity on the size. Can you tell me about how do you think fund size affects performance?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, we've been quite clear since launch that we've got a soft close of 100 million sterling and a hard close at 200 million, which is for many firms, that's seen as far too small. I mean, for many firms and for some potential investors as well, actually. You know, many firms would look at, you know, a few hundred million as being a kind of minimum, you know, profitable size for a fund and would have aspirations to grow their funds into, you know, kind of multi-billions. Because obviously, from a business perspective, the bigger the fund, the more profitable the business is, because it's a, you know, highly operational leveraged industry. A lot of your costs are fixed. And so, you know, bigger AUM equals bigger fees, you know, and that kind of drops through to the bottom line. So there's a clear incentive in the industry to grow bigger and bigger funds. I mean, I think the key issue, as we see it, is that size will always impact on performance. So, you know, if you're managing £100 million versus £1 billion, that step up in size is going to reduce the pool of companies that are available for you to invest in because of liquidity reasons. And so by reducing your opportunity set, by definition, you know, you reduce your opportunity to create alpha. So so size always impacts on performance. And I think, you know, for the most part, firms approach this problem by saying, what's the most we can justify managing so that the impact of size on performance is kind of reasonable? What can we get away with, if you like? We've tried to turn that question on its head and say, well, size always impacts on performance. What's the least we think we can manage it and still have a viable business? So we've really put the focus on performance rather than on the kind of business profitability.
Okay, yeah, absolutely. And it seems like proponents of big funds seem to have quite kind of two big arguments in terms of price, you know, so economies of scale making them cheaper, and then the risk as well, and there's supposedly less risk because there's some sort of safety in numbers. What do you kind of say to those two arguments in particular?
Trustnet did a study of the lowest cost actively managed funds in the UK and across developed markets globally. And our fund, the VT Cape Wrath Focus Fund, was the third lowest actively managed fund in the UK. And arguably the first and second lowest cost were kind of barely actively managed, to be honest. So, I mean, I think that really tells a lie of the point about price. You know, you can, you know, we are able to have a low cost fund despite our small size because we have a low cost base and we also subsidize some of the expenses incurred by the fund itself. So large doesn't necessarily mean low cost. And then secondly, I mean, I haven't really heard an effective argument about why large funds are a lower risk. I mean, that simply doesn't make sense to me. I'd say it's the opposite, in fact. The bigger the fund is, the more likely they are to have liquidity issues, the more likely they are to present some kind of systemic risk. You know, if you look at the case of Neil Woodford, you know, many people say, well, this is an argument against boutique funds. But I mean, Woodford Asset Management was hardly a boutique. They had over 10 billion in assets at their peak. It was, you know, and I think the regulator has kind of used that story to their own ends as an argument against small funds rather than actually looking at the kind of core causes of it. So I think, you know, there's absolutely no nothing behind the argument that a large fund presents lower risk. It's exactly the opposite.
And speaking of the regulator that you just mentioned, it seems it's angling for fewer larger operators because it's supposedly easier to regulate. It's the same thing that's happening in the advice industry with the FCA wanting bigger firms because it's easier to regulate, supposedly. What's your stance on this sort of policy decision, and how do you think small funds should sort of push against that?
Well, I think that, I mean, the FCA is basically in breach of their, you know, the FCA has got three statutory objectives, and the third one is promoting effective competition. And they undermine that by pushing back against small firms, because that's how you create a healthy ecosystem that promotes competition. So I think, you know, unfortunately, the FCA has become effectively a dysfunctional organization. And that's not just my view. You know, the Public Accounts Committee in July published a report effectively saying the FCA has become a dysfunctional organization. So, you know, the role of the regulator should exist to serve consumers in the market. But the FCA has twisted that and come to the view that really, you know, the market exists to make the FCA's life easier, you know, by trying to create an environment in which they've got the least work to do, rather than standing there to try and support the environment and, you know, promote competition in a healthy ecosystem. So it's unfortunate that we operate in a market where we have a dysfunctional regulator. And I'm sure I know there are many good people at the FCA, but there's a cultural issue, there's a leadership issue there. How do small funds push against it? Well, you know, it's a kind of David and Goliath situation. It's not a huge amount, that you can do, you know, in the face of the regulator. So I think, you know, we just have to, small fund managers, you know, just have to keep on doing what they do best, which is to provide, you know, interesting, differentiated products that fill gaps, niches in the market, and, you know, let the market decide whether there is an appetite for those funds and products.
And so how do you suggest that small funds kind of remain competitive and attractive? Is it just by making sure that they kind of get good returns? Well, how do you kind of remain competitive when there's a...
Yeah, I mean, I think the key point is differentiation, I think, and finding, you know, these maybe less liquid pockets where there are interesting kind of returns to be had, interesting strategies to execute. So I think that there will always be a role for smaller funds, because there'll always be inefficient pockets of the market that can't be accessed by bulge bracket funds.
Mm-hmm. So it's about kind of differentiating themselves and finding that kind of unique characteristic in a way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so we've talked about the sort of advantages of small funds over bigger ones, but obviously we also have to talk about the sort of drawbacks of it. What do you think are some of the disadvantages of small funds, and how do you mitigate those?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key disadvantage is that if the fund is too small, there is an operational risk angle. So, you know, the fund has to work as a business ultimately. So I think that there is, you know, a sweet spot. It will depend on the cost base of the manager, but there's maybe a, you know, and it will depend on the asset class that they're operating in and the, you know, the market environment. But, you know, somewhere between 50 and 150 million possibly is this kind of sweet spot where the fund is large enough that the business and operational risk, you know, takes care of itself, and it's still small and nimble enough to take advantage of differentiated or less liquid opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So a lot of our listeners are not particularly kind of investment experts, but how would you sort of sell the idea of prioritizing smaller funds to an advisor who may not be an expert in this area? How would you try and sell it?
I mean, I think from the advisor's perspective, small funds have a purpose insofar as they can allow the advisor to provide a point of differentiation for their client. So they can say, well, rather than, you know, going to a competitor where they're going to offer you these funds from Fidelity and Invesco and Jupiter and, you know, the kind of bulge bracket managers, actually, I've got this other list of really interesting funds that you probably haven't heard of before that are doing something different, where I think there's an opportunity to add them to your, you know, to your portfolio and to provide differentiated returns. So I think that's, you know, that's a key one, key selling point. I think, you know, as an advisor, if you're interested in allocating to managers who are kind of following their passion rather than following the money, then, you know, I think you should think about small funds. And if you're kind of interested in supporting the, you know, the Davids over the Goliaths, then you should think about small funds.
Okay, I see. Hopefully that is a sales pitch that works for our listeners. At the beginning of the episode, I mentioned that there was two kind of problems in the fund industry that you had opinions on, and the first one being fund size, and the second being the fee structures and how they're not always kind of beneficial to investors. Can you tell me a little bit more about that and your opinions on that specific topic?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think an issue, certainly when we launched the fund, is that of kind of closet trackers. So funds which are so large that effectively their performance is always going to be benchmark plus or minus a couple of percent, but they charge kind of active management fees. You know, maybe they charge, you know, 80 basis points, 1% annual management fee for effectively doing what the client could do in a much lower cost way with a tracker fund or an ETF. So I think that's a key issue in the industry. And so we designed our fee structure to kind of overcome that issue and to try and kind of show that it's possible to incentivize the manager to provide kind of differentiated returns. And so our fee structure is based around a very low annual management charge. At the moment, we've got a 15 basis point AMC. So effectively, you know, if we perform like a tracker fund, then we will be paid like a tracker fund. And then we have a performance fee on top of that. The performance fee only kicks in if we're above our high watermark and we beat our benchmark. So we've got to deliver positive absolute and relative performance in order to earn the performance fee. And I think that, you know, this kind of fee structure of pairing a very low tracker type AMC with a performance fee means that the manager of a high performing but capacity constrained strategy can be compensated similarly to the manager of a benchmark performing high capacity strategy.
And so where do you think the industry is heading in terms of both fund size and fee structure? How do you see the sort of landscape evolving in that regard?
Yeah, I think in terms of, I mean, fee structures, there's definitely, you know, we now have ETFs that effectively have, you know, as kind of zero AMC or as close to as. So, you know, I think that kind of fees have gone a long way in terms of the journey that they need to go on. And I think you end up, you know, you go towards more of a kind of barbell setup where you have very low cost tracker funds, and then you have more differentiated niche products that can justify, you know, charging higher fees. I think in terms of kind of industry size, I don't think it's really a kind of linear journey. I think there are, you know, cycles in the industry. You know, what we have seen in recent years is more advisors looking to differentiate themselves. You know, there's been a lot of consolidation in the industry. A lot of advisors have found themselves pushed more towards centralized lists. And that journey can only go so far until people, you know, clients say, well, we're just getting offered all of these, you know, same lists by, you know, where's the differentiation between these different advisors when they're all picking off the same lists? And so that then, you know, creates an incentive for some perhaps more entrepreneurial advisors to start you know, developing more interesting lists, you know, some individuals to go off list or offer their clients, you know, kind of lists of funds that they don't see elsewhere. And that then, you know, creates a market for smaller funds. And you know, I think there's certainly a number of what I call multi-boutiques that are gaining traction at the moment. So these are small fund houses that are set up to provide a home for these kind of more niche boutique type managers. You know, the more successful of those multi-boutiques are probably the bulge bracket managers of, you know, of tomorrow. So, you know, there's a kind of cycle, you know, basically that goes on, I think. But I think we're, you know, at a point where there is probably more, although, you know, clearly not from the FCA perspective, but elsewhere in the industry, I think there's a recognition of the benefit of small managers. And we're seeing that in the emergence of more of these kind of multi-boutique type firms to support boutique managers on that journey.
Right. So in your opinion, the future is bright for Cape Wrath Capital and other small funds?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Well, I think that's a great note to end on, actually. So, Adam, thank you so much for being here, and thank you, everybody, for listening. If you'd like to get in contact with us about this episode, we're on Twitter at New Model Advisor, or feel free to get in contact with me, cmelly@citywire.co.uk. Thanks again, everyone. Thank you, Adam, and we will see you next week.
This CityWire podcast is sponsored by Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust. Scottish Mortgage invests in some of the world's most promising and exceptional companies, from healthcare breakthroughs to electric vehicles to a green energy revolution. Scottish Mortgage takes stakes in businesses shaping our future economy and society. As with any investment, capital is at risk.